with respect to access. And that's because, you know, most of the effective treatments are under intellectual property control by just a few corporations. And there is, you know, for the time being, at least this year, no major supply available through anyone besides those originator companies. And even that which is available through those companies is in very limited stock and purchased mostly by high-income countries. So, you know, unfortunately, we're just making the same mistakes over and over again. The same mistakes we made with vaccines and access to vaccines early on in the pandemic is the same mistake we're making with treatments right now.
Let me ask Fatima Hassan in South Africa, is the pandemic ending?
Not from where we're sitting, no.
And Mihir Mankad, with Doctors Without Borders, you have this global perspective. What do you see right now?
No, I don't think we're in a position to claim that the pandemic's ending, and you know, neither that WHO has also not indicated that the pandemic is ending anytime soon.
And finally, Fatima, what do you think would be the single most important action could be taken right now to deal with this ongoing pandemic?
So unfortunately, because we have this weak deal, I think the single pressing thing that needs to happen is that every single country in the global south has to start issuing compulsory licenses, but not just on vaccines, also on treatments and on diagnostics, because they are ordinarily permitted to do that under the TRIPS agreement. So if we don't have strong domestic action or strong domesticating
of
the
weak
deal, we won't be able to get out of this pandemic.
Fatima Hassan, we want to thank you for being with us. Health Justice Initiative, speaking to us from South Africa. And Mihir Mankad with Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, speaking to us from New York City. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Masaya Rhodes, Maria Tarasena. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO is looking for our next membership director. KBOO's members are the heart and soul of our community, and we need a dedicated person to honor and foster this relationship. Are you the right person to steward and manage KBOO's membership department, or do you know someone who is? Go to kboo.fm to learn more about the essential functions of the membership director and the qualifications we are looking for. You can also apply by mailing your resume and cover letter to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Members make KBOO happen. Help us show them how much they do.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregonians need to gear up for extreme temperatures of both heat and cold this coming weekend. The governors of the Pacific Northwest push back on a plan to suspend gas taxes. And the latest COVID-19 variant is likely to be infecting a lot more people in Oregon than previously thought. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 23rd, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. As President Biden pushes for a federal gas tax suspension for several months, Pacific Northwest governors are pushing back against suspending taxes on fuel in Oregon and Washington. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has the story.
Oregon and Washington governors have indicated they are unlikely to suspend gas taxes following President Joe Biden's Wednesday plea to Congress to halt federal gas taxes for 3 months and urging that states do the same on a local level. Washington's gas tax is the third highest in the nation at 49 cents a gallon, while Oregon isn't far behind with a gas tax of 38 cents a gallon, far above the federal gas tax of just 18 cents per gallon. Oregon Governor Kate Brown said she is skeptical of a gas tax halt, with her office releasing a statement this week saying that it was unlikely Oregonians would see a significant savings at the pump under these proposals. Brown's office maintained that the state should instead make targeted investments to help Oregonians feeling the rising costs of living the most, including $240,000 $1,000 direct payments of $600 to families sent out this week, the $400 million investment the state is making in housing, and the $100 million investment that is being made in childcare. Washington Governor Jay Inslee also indicating his reluctance to do so, citing that money that could help repair local infrastructure would instead be going into rich oil company pockets. President Biden's proposed gas tax holiday claims it could save drivers roughly $3 per every 15-gallon fill-up, as gas prices have soared to a national average of over $5 a gallon. In a White House speech regarding the gas tax holiday, Biden said, quote, "I'm doing my part. I want Congress, states, and industry to do their part as well," end quote. Despite recent studies showing a temporary gas tax halt could lower prices at the pump, some economists are wary of the move, questioning how much consumers would save as gas prices could continue to rise, then spike once the gas tax holiday ends. President and CEO of the American Road and Transportation Builders Association, Dave Bauer, said even a temporary gas tax holiday, quote, "sets a bad precedent and undermines the funding mechanism in the infrastructure investment law that has been the signature policy achievement of the Biden presidency," end quote. Congress appears skeptical as well, with lawmakers from both parties expressing hesitancy, if not downright opposition, to the proposal.
Recent data from sewage samples collected from wastewater treatment plants are indicating that the BA2 Omicron variant has infected far more people throughout Oregon than previously thought. In May, the newest wave of the COVID variant stemming from the Omicron family appeared to peak, with infection rates at roughly 1,500 cases per day, far lower than previous waves of the virus strains. Oregon State University has been conducting wastewater testing as part of its national COVID-19 wastewater surveillance program, and its most current results show that viral concentrations are approaching record highs, rivaling and possibly surpassing peak infection rates during the Delta wave and Omicron's January surge. Earlier this month, the concentration of virus in wastewater statewide registered as strong, with some communities, including Bend and Forest Grove, showing even higher concentrations. Spokespeople leading the OSU project cite the rise in home testing and a decrease in disease severity as masking the greater spread, with fewer people going in to get clinical results. Public health officials have turned to testing wastewater samples from treatment plants as a potentially more accurate way to determine coronavirus infection. Though wastewater sampling does not determine disease severity, it is a stronger tool for detection as the virus begins showing up in people's waste often before symptoms arise and before decisions on testing are made. The OSU team collects samples from more than 40 wastewater treatment plants statewide, taking weekly samples over a 24-hour period that are shipped to Corvallis, where scientists scrutinize those samples to identify viral RNA. This process can produce results in 3 to 5 days, and it's more accurate than clinical results in detecting possible trends in infection hotspots. With most of the state leveling off in infections, current regions of Southern Oregon are still on the rise, and with Eugene and Springfield hosting the World Athletic Championships and International Track and Field Competition, wastewater testing could prove to be a valuable tool in containing the further spread of the virus in those areas. The wastewater testing data is available to the public through the Oregon Health Authority's website, and people are encouraged to look at it to better understand where the virus is spreading or declining. Oregonians should be prepared for hot and cold temperatures this weekend. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Authorities are warning Oregonians about both hot and cold temperatures. A high-pressure ridge is expected to arrive on Friday. So, after months of rain and relatively cool temperatures, the highs are forecast to reach well into the 90s this weekend. National Weather Service meteorologist John Bumgardner says, quote, "hitting 100 looks unlikely at this point, but it's not completely out of the question. We're thinking around 95, 96, end quote. The hot weather is also causing authorities to worry about wildfires. They say every year we see fires started because of improper use or use of illegal fireworks. Last summer's heat wave broke regional high temperature records for the Pacific Northwest and tied a longstanding record for the hottest temperature ever recorded in the state. The State Climate Extremes Committee verified a maximum temperature of 119 degrees in central Oregon. On the other hand, cold water temperatures are also causing worry. The Willamette River, for example, is still in the 50s. Experts believe people may try and stay cool by swimming, but they warn jumping into 50-degree water can be dangerous. Temperatures that low can cause cold water shock, which could be fatal. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon fire departments got some good news this week as the state awarded $6 million in grants to help ease staffing shortages just as the state enters wildfire season. The state awarded $35,000 grants to more than 160 fire departments across the state, stemming from Senate Bill 762, which lawmakers passed following Oregon's harrowing 2020 fire season. Currently, the state's firefighter workforce is down about 20%, with former employees citing low pay, a lack of benefits, and poor working conditions as reasons for leaving. This week's grants announcement aims to assist agencies in recruiting more federal firefighters and to keep current ones from leaving. Volunteer firefighters have also diminished in numbers in recent years in many departments statewide, causing further staffing concerns during peak season and leaving smaller, more rural communities more vulnerable. Mount Angel's Fire District Chief commented on the funding, saying, "We're going to be able to pay some of our volunteers and give our full-time people overtime to be able to staff this station during our most critical hours." Mount Angel is one of several rural agencies in Marion County whose collective response has provided crucial assistance in helping to fight major fires across the Willamette Valley and beyond. State fire officials say these grants are just temporary to get Oregon through this year's wildfire season, and they're designed as a model to see if the added funding will ultimately have a positive impact in departments for the long term. In many parts of the West, experts warn conditions are ripe for large fires. As Suzanne Potter reports, we're likely to see them as the drought persists.
Fire season is now upon us, and local experts are speaking out on best practices for dealing with large wildfires, which seem to be Nevada's new normal. Continuing drought and high temperatures linked to climate change have created the same conditions that led to 610 fires last year, which burned more than 134,000 acres. UNR Assistant Professor Christina Restano directs the Living with Fire program that teaches communities how to get ready.
You need to prepare your own home and the property around your home by doing proper defensible space, also through creating an evacuation plan for both family and your animals.
In addition, Restano says people need to plan for smoky skies and poor air quality, and she believes more people are needed to help educate the community, study wildfire risk, and reduce the fuel load on the wildland-urban interface. Dr. Tim Brown with the Desert Research Institute in Reno says the impact on people will be twofold.
It's going to be respiratory issues. Last year, compounded with COVID. On the mental side, it's the stress of dealing with those physical impacts, but also wondering just how bad is this season going to be.
Jennifer Cantley with Moms Clean Air Force says she relies on EPA data from the website airnow.gov. At one point, she says it showed Douglas County with more red air quality days than Washoe or Clark counties.
It showed that the rural communities do have dirty air just as much as the big cities, even though it's overlooked, and most of the time they don't have air monitoring systems.
Data from the Nevada Department of Wildlife indicate the problem is only getting worse. More than 9 million acres of Nevada's landscape burned between 2000 and 2020, which is double the acreage lost to wildfire between 1980 and 1999. For Nevada News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The latest report from leading climate scientists warns that greenhouse gas emissions need to peak within 3 years and then start going down in order to avoid the most catastrophic impacts of climate change. As Eric Glottis reports, an upcoming weekend climate summit is getting underway in the West.
Wyomingites concerned about bigger and more frequent wildfires, prolonged drought, threats to clean air, water, and wildlife can explore ways to combat climate change in their own community at the Wyoming Climate Summit this Saturday in Lander. Summit co-organizer Ariel Green says the climate crisis is not a hypothetical future event. In the 20th century, Lander saw an average of 17 days a year with temperatures at 90 degrees or above. The past 2 years saw 44 days at 90 or above.
So these changes are already here, and they're everywhere, and they affect us all, and they will be dramatically intensified in coming years if we do not mitigate their cause, which is the emission of heat-trapping gases from certain kinds of human activity.
Members of the Wind River Reservation are joining the summit to pass along indigenous knowledge gained living sustainably across the Mountain West for thousands of years. The summit is free and open to the public and will feature an electric car show, including the new Ford Mustang Mach-E. Saturday's event kicks off at 9 a.m. at the Lander Community Center. Wyoming, long dependent on fossil fuels for jobs and tax revenues, has opposed transitioning away from coal and other greenhouse gas-producing energy sources. But Green argues the state is uniquely positioned to play a major role in the coming zero-emission economy. Wyoming ranks sixth nationally for untapped wind energy potential.
We're tied, I think, for the eighth best solar resource in the country, ahead of Florida. We have a lot of potential for geothermal power and next generation geothermal power. We have a lot of knowledge about how to dig deep holes in the ground.
Nearly 6 in 10 Wyoming residents understand that climate change is happening, according to Yale University analysis. Green believes most folks just need a few tips to start creating solutions in their hometown.
People are concerned about climate change, but are not really active in doing anything about it, and maybe don't know what to do about it. So we're trying to educate them about ways they can get involved.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Wyoming News Service.
In efforts to better improve transit reliability and bus service, TriMet announced it will be temporarily reducing 10 routes, eliminating 2 beginning in mid-September. With growing shortages in operators, TriMet transit routes have seen more delays, disruptions, and lack of service. The 10 routes impacted by this reduction are on lines where ridership is lower than others. Routes affected include the cancellations of Bus Line 50 Cedar Mill and of Bus Line 92 South Beaverton Express. And with reductions in Bus Lines 1 Vermont, 18 Hillsdale, and 26 Thurman Northwest 18th Avenue. Extra weekday rush hour routes will also face restructuring, including lines 8 Jackson Park, Northeast 15th, 9 Powell Boulevard, and 72 Killingsworth 82nd Avenue. Bus line 81 Kane 257th will have cancellations and extra trips added during the pandemic to assist with social distancing, and the low ridership line 82 South Gresham will lessen to hourly frequency. TriMet urges transit riders to sign up for service alerts at trimet.org to keep up with rescheduled routes and unexpected delays. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, clear skies, a low around 50. Tomorrow's weather, mainly sunny skies and a high of 83. Today in history, on this date in 1972, the Title IX Education Amendment was enacted into law, prohibiting federally funded educational institutions from discriminating against students or employees based on sex, vastly increasing opportunities for female athletes. Our quote of the day is from Title IX. No person in the United States shall, based on sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. The U.S. Supreme Court is expecting to announce its decision soon on a major abortion case. It's Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, and it'll be a pivotal decision that could reverse abortion access soon. As Eric Tegedoff reports, the issue is a political flashpoint that could be more divisive because of the human anxiety about death.
The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to announce its decision on a case that could upend abortion access across the country. This topic is a source of fiery debate, and one reason for that could be because of our anxiety about death. At a webinar on Wednesday hosted by the Seattle-based Ernest Becker Foundation, panelists discussed the link between the anthropologist's work on terror management theory and the issue of abortion. Dr. Emily Courtney is a social psychologist at the University of South Florida. She says people manage their anxiety about death by constructing worldviews, such as religions, ideologies, and political orientations. but it also makes people defensive when that worldview is challenged, making topics such as abortion more divisive.
The fact that we deal with the death anxiety by putting more of our own kind of personal stake in the ideologies that we've adopted as human beings, when those things are threatened, we take a step back and things get a little bit more intense when we do confront those issues.
A leaked Supreme Court opinion on the Mississippi abortion case showed justices could be preparing to overturn the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, which legalized abortion. Regardless of the ruling, the option will remain legal in Washington state. Courtney says death is a large part of terror management theory, but there also are other components to our fear of death. They include existential threats to our identity and autonomy. Courtney says these types of threats can present themselves when someone isn't able to make the choice to get an abortion.
So by limiting those choices, you're presenting more of an existential threat to specific groups of people, women, people who may be marginalized in society, people who may be in different socioeconomic tiers who could simply not support children.
Dr. Lindsay Harvell Bowman is director of the Terror Management Lab at James Madison University and also participated in Wednesday's webinar. She explored more hopeful messages of empathy and trying to neutralize the terror management defense that can come up on issues such as abortion. Harvell Bowman says it's important to humanize people on the other side of this issue from you, and that communication is the way to get there.
We're all human. We all end the same way. And so really, in order to enact change, we have to engage in meaningful conversation with each other without completely ruining the other side.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
President Biden calls for a 3-month suspension of the federal gas tax. Fed Chair Jerome Powell says a recession is a possibility. And U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, expresses his support for the bipartisan gun bill. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Now, I fully understand that a gas tax holiday alone is not going to fix the problem, but it will provide families some immediate relief, just a little bit of breathing room.
President Biden called on Congress to suspend the federal gas tax for 3 months and urged oil companies to increase production and refining capacity. Wyoming Representative John Barrasso and other GOP leaders criticized the Biden administration's attempts to provide relief at the pump.
Why are we in this position? Because Joe Biden continues to take the side of the radical, extreme environmentalists who want to strangle American energy.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell told lawmakers Wednesday a recession is a possibility and addressed interest rate hikes he says are aimed at tackling inflation.
My colleagues and I are acutely aware that high inflation poses significant hardship, especially on those least able to meet the higher costs of essentials like food, housing, and transportation.
A procedural Senate vote on the bipartisan gun safety bill passed 64-34 in less than 2 hours after the final text was released, paving the way to a final vote. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he's advocating for the legislation becoming law.
I hope we'll be able to pass it. I think it's a significant step in the right direction to deal with the two issues that I think it focuses on, school safety and mental health.
The bill would expand background checks for prospective gun buyers between the ages of 18 and 21 and incentivize states to provide access to juvenile records. At a Texas Senate committee hearing in response to the Uvalde school shooting, Baylor College psychiatry professor Dr. Laurel Williams talked about expanding the state's mental health services child psychiatry access network to give families quick and easy access to mental health professionals.
So when they call, they can hear back from us within 5 minutes, and if they need to speak to a child psychiatrist within 30 minutes.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled the state of Maine may not exclude religious schools from a state tuition program. This is the first time this particular restriction on non-sectarian schools has reached the United States Supreme Court in more than 4 decades. Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty Vice President Eric Rosbach.
Anyone who lives in Maine can get this tuition benefit. Once you've opened it up, they said,
then it creates a problem because you're essentially penalizing people for sending their kid to a school that has religious exercise.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Federal Energy Information Agency reports in 2020, the U.S. natural gas transportation network delivered about 27.7 trillion cubic feet of natural gas to more than 77 million customers. But there is a price in the form of leaks that can cause damage, deaths, and pollution. Mark Richardson reports on a new study that finds serious leak incidents across the U.S. at the rate of 1 every 40 hours.
A new study shows that almost daily leaks along America's 310,000-mile network of natural gas pipelines are causing death, injury, and large-scale property damage. The report from the Arizona PIRG Education Fund finds over the past decade, pipeline incidents serious enough to require reporting occurred every 40 hours. Diane Brown with Arizona PIRG says the report found between 2010 and 2021, 2,600 explosions killed 122 people, seriously injured 600, and cost Americans more than $4 billion.
Leaks can occur anywhere from the transport of gas from the well through the gathering and transmission pipelines and the distribution lines that carry gas to homes and businesses.
The report, published this week in conjunction with the nonprofit Frontier Group, also found that pipeline leaks in Arizona and elsewhere released 26 billion cubic feet of methane, a greenhouse gas pollutant linked to climate change. Brown adds the serious pipeline incidents addressed in the report likely represent only some of the leaks experienced in producing, transporting, and burning gas.
Federally reported gas leaks represent just a fraction of the total. Not all serious gas explosions that have caused death or injury are included in the data if they did not occur in the pipeline system.
Report calls for the U.S. to stop relying so heavily on methane for home heating and cooking, as well as electricity generation. Brown says Arizona regulators have already started down that road.
The Arizona Corporation Commission is starting to look at some of the risks posed by gas. The commission has brought Southwest Gas before them to discuss recent incidents that have caused Arizonans harm.
In addition to calling for tougher regulations, Arizona PIRG is advocating for better pipeline infrastructure with improved gas leak detection systems. The study, along with gas safety tips for consumers, is online at arizonapergedfund.org. I'm Mark Richardson for Arizona News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Secretary Deb Haaland and other leaders testify at the U.S. Senate about a boarding school's report and investigation. And a Native community bans outside tour operators. Here's Antonia Gonzalez with the latest edition of National Native News.
Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland vows to continue to investigate U.S. Indian boarding schools and support healing efforts for tribal communities impacted by intergenerational trauma caused by the schools. Many students faced physical, mental, spiritual, and sexual abuse, and many students did not make it back home. Haaland testified Wednesday before the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs on the findings of the first part of her Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative, which she announced last June. A report released in May found there were 408 schools across the U.S. from 1819 to 1969, and about 59 marked or unmarked burial sites identified. Boarding school policies focused on cultural assimilation and the forced removal and relocation of Native children. Haaland says as the investigation continues, the next step is to gather testimony, find support for healing, and resources for language and culture programs.
I recently announced that we will embark on the Road to Healing, a tour throughout the nation to hear directly from survivors and descendants about their experiences. A necessary part of this journey will be to connect survivors and their families with mental health support and to create a permanent collection of oral histories. We know this won't be easy, but it is a history that we must learn from if we are to heal from this tragic era in our country.
The hearing also focused on Indian boarding school legislation, which would create a commission to help locate and analyze records and hold culturally appropriate hearings. Sandra Whitehawk, board president of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, was among a panel of Native leaders to testify in support of the legislation.
It will open up
wounds, but in order for us to heal, we need to air out those wounds and replace them with the medicines that we have within our ceremonies and with our songs, along with our mental health professionals that can help us as well. But most importantly, what was taken from us, which is our songs, our life ways, that it will bring the healing when our wounds are open from that. There was an elder that was one of my teachers, my most influential teachers in my life, and he said, we are a people that are well acquainted with grief. And I've watched and seen that as we've gone into communities and listened to experiences and watched healing take place.
Senators on the Indian Affairs Committee, including Chair Brian Schatz, committed to continue to push the boarding school legislation forward and to help find appropriations. Leaders of an indigenous community in Sonora, Mexico, have banned outside tour operators from bringing in visitors. Instead, they're asking tourists to arrange visits directly with members of the community. From the Fronteras desk, KJZZ's Kendall Blust reports.
The Comecoq New Year, the community's most important celebration, is coming up at the end of this month. And ahead of what's often a popular tourist event, leaders are asking visitors to directly contract boat rides, lodging, and other services with members of the community.
El enemigo es el trato desigual que hace más grande la marginación.
Alberto Mellado, who represents the tribe with the municipal government, says the request comes after years of abuse by outside tour operators that increases the marginalization of his community. He says those businesses charge tourists significant sums of money to bring them to Comecoq territory, but little, if any, of that money goes to members of the community. He says the Comecoq Nation wants tourists to visit, but is opposed to the benefits of those visits disproportionately going to outsiders who take advantage of the beautiful land and seascapes that Comecoq people have protected for millennia. I'm Kendall Blust in Hermosillo.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 23rd, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Jeffrey Wade, Eric Tegadoff, Suzanne Potter, Eric Galatis, and Mark Richardson. The producers, Annette Newell, and our engineers, Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening.